This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Alex von Goldstein. We're going to be discussing the films Mishima and Taxi Driver. Alex, great having you on.
Robert, it's always a pleasure, and it's going to be fun to talk about these two movies. I think that they're two of the best films of the last 50 years, and there's themes in them that are super universal and super pertinent. They total parallels to a lot of modern political stuff.
And both of those films were written by Paul Schrader.
Yeah, and he directed. Well, I think his brother wrote Mishima. Schrader wrote Taxi Driver, which was directed by Martin Scorsese, and I believe his brother, who had a Japanese wife, actually wrote Mishima, but he directed Mishima. I'm sure he was involved with the script as well, but I know it was a family affair of the Schraders to some degree, and his brother's wife was a Japanese woman.
And both of those films, they deal with a lot of the same themes.
Certainly.
Themes of alienation, and there's also a kind of a Nietzschean theme to it about powering yourself.
Sure. I think there are a lot of parallels between the two films. The most obvious one is that both films, Taxi Driver and Mishima, center around one man, Travis Bickle, played by Robert De Niro in the case of Taxi Driver, and then Yukio Mishima, played by Ken Ogata in the film Mishima. And both films start out with a very weak man, a frail man, who is taunted and intimidated by the outside world, and then makes a mental change, an effort to change material reality. And he changes his body, he changes his lifestyle, he militarizes himself in both examples. Both films go on very different paths, and they are about two very different men, but they are about two of the same almost archetype. You know, Travis Bickle and Yukio Mishima are the same, you know, archetype. They're the same kind of man, but they exist in very different worlds. And almost on a, you know, just almost a biological level, you have a European man, an Italian man in New York in the 1970s, in the case of Travis Bickle. And then
I think that story also ends slightly earlier. I think it was around like the early 70s.
Yes, he kills himself in 1970, it's when he committed seppuku.
The film takes place over a longer period of time.
Over a long period of time. And
I think it starts maybe like prior to World War II.
Yes. And then, you know, it shows Mishima's experience growing up in wartime Japan and how he basically develops and grows as a person. And Mishima and Travis Bickle, I would say, to a degree, are examples of aristocratic individualism. I think it's because of Bickle's dumb wits that he doesn't, sort of LARP to the level that Mishima does, which is making his own paramilitary organization. Travis Bickle sort of just has his little kind of, you know, getting his weapons together and trying to commit some kind of heroic act of a meaningless heroic act. Whereas, but he's still aiming to sort of be a hero and achieve an actualized self. Mishima, he's a bit more successful. He has ideas that are defined and multi-layered. And, you know, because of this, he's able to get men on his side. You know, he is of a higher level and seen by people as a higher level, Yukio Mishima. Bickle is, you know, he makes an impact on some level, but he's still a loser at the end of the day. It's all in his head.
How would you kind of explain the concept of aristocratic individualism to like your average person, or even to someone who's fairly intellectual who's not familiar with the concept?
Sure, yeah. Aristocratic individualism. Tie it to anarchist thought, and I think that a lot of people who are aristocratic individualists often become anarchists. But I think that there's this idea. Are you familiar with Anton LaVey's concept of the born Satanist?
No.
Well, Anton LaVey said that Satanists are not made. You don't wake up and convert to Satanism. You are born a Satanist. And Emma Goldman, the Jewish anarchist, she said this about anarchists. She says you don't read books and then decide to become an anarchist. You sort of are an anarchist. You know, there's this kind of spirit of, you know, the anarchist or the Satanist even. You know, there's just different labels that you can kind of put on this sort of person who decides to follow their own will. Their own will to achieving an actualized self. And to understand what an aristocratic individualist is, you have to look at examples of people who can kind of be categorized as an aristocratic individualist. So who do we have? J.R.R. Tolkien, who is the author of the Lord of the Rings series. You have Aleister Crowley, who was, someone who had a lot of involvement with the occult. H.L. Mencken, who was a writer and an anarchist and a really acerbic guy with a really brilliant writer with a sort of just jabbing at every kind of sacred cow of culture. Salvador Dali. The aristocratic individualist and also Ernst Jünger. You can view Ernst Jünger as an aristocratic individualist. And it's... And of course, Nietzsche. I'm not sure if I just said that, but definitely Nietzsche. And when you list all these people who are the aristocratic individualists, you can kind of get a feeling for who or what kind of person I'm referring to.
The thing with aristocratic individualists is that they don't fit into existing hierarchies because they want to rebel against existing hierarchies and power structures. But at the same time, they don't fit into this whole like anarchist individualist concept of just everyone can do what they want, because these are people who have a very strong vision.
Yes, exactly.
Of what society should yes. ideally be.
Yes, exactly.
Obviously, that was the case with Mishima.
Certainly, the aristocratic individualist is not a liberal. It's not a. Someone like Crowley would say, "Do what thou wilt," but. You know, this is a very complicated concept. It's sort of, you know, even with Nietzsche, Nietzsche's ideas, you know, you have thinkers like Nietzsche, Max Stirner, Heidegger, Hegel, and a lot of these thinkers have been reappropriated by leftists and pushed forward as kind of leftist thinkers. Like, there's a leftist interpretation of Nietzsche. And people look at this idea of, you know, becoming who you are, achieving your higher self, following the will, this sort of thinking. They reframe it to fit into leftist, universalist egalitarianism, which, you know, is not at the core of what Nietzsche was truly saying, you know, or what he was saying for himself, you know, this something that is much more in line with aristocratic individualism than with leftism. And it's about, you know, the person who is the aristocratic individualist has a vision for society, but the other people within the world of the aristocratic individualist are people who need to realize themselves. You know, there's an element, a distinction, you know, a kind of line drawn in the sand between those who live their truth and those who deny reality and accept a false narrative in order to please others around them. And you have those kind of, I mean, this is what Heidegger is talking about. Heidegger is talking about the authentic, you know, the Dasein being is what he says, like, you know, you have the authentic and then the inauthentic. And the inauthentic are the sheep, the crowd. This is what, these are who most people are. And the authentic are the ones who stand and turn and go their own way. And every movement is going to mostly be full of sheep. You have sheep being led by wolves, and the owls are the ones who can fly out of the system and be their own people. You know, Nietzsche said the Superman. Max Stirner has a ton of writing on this. And that's what Travis Bickle is trying to do in Taxi Driver. He's,
and these are the kind of individuals who are usually kind of alienated by society. And then there's also this sort of concept of being a loser and whether people are great, like these great aristocratic individualists who are sort of being denied their rightful place because they don't conform into the values of the masses.
Certainly.
But then I've also heard people say that they'll say, oh, you're just a loser and you're using that as like a coping mechanism.
Well, you've just... in doing this, you have just laid out the two opposing forces that every aristocratic individualist has to face within their life. You know, the people that are going to slam you and call you a loser, and Mishima has this in his movie. You know, in the film, he stands up and speaks to leftist students who, you know, he's and has his whole diatribe about the emperor.
Oh, yeah.
And the leftist
that
students.
That was a great scene. And they laughed at him and they dismissed him. But he had an interesting point because he actually said, like, I'm fighting the same forces that you're fighting. And he was referring to kind of like a mass consumerism.
Certainly.
And they just kind of dismissed him.
Exactly.
That reminds me of a lot of the things that are like discussed by like groups, by a lot of these different thinkers and like the new right.
Yeah, like the new right and the new left have a lot in common. And if you go and read someone like Alain de Benoist, you can see a clear, you know, he's almost like the Venn diagram. You know, in the middle of the Venn diagram, there's ideas that kind of, you know, you have idea set A, idea set B, what's C, what's in the middle. And that's Alain de Benoist. He's like new left and new right at the same time. And even someone like Jonathan Bowden, he's certainly an aristocratic individualist, a Nietzschean type. Bowden would say you have to combine the forces of light and dark. You have to combine the forces of, you know, good and evil or whatever. You know, Nietzsche, he has Beyond Good and Evil is Beyond Good and Evil is the title of one of his books. And something that that Heidegger, what Heidegger would warn his students about was the coming, global technological materialism. You know, and that's what SJWism and political correctness is, the religion of global technological materialism. And the reason why Heidegger joined the Nazis, joined the National Socialist Party in the early 30s, or might have been, I'm not sure when it was early on. The reason why Heidegger joined is because he saw the National Socialists as a force against global technological materialism. He saw them as a force against it. And in a lot of ways, you can see Mishima doing the same thing, rebelling against the modern world, which is, the global technological materialism. And, you know, you can see the Japanese author Natsume Soseki, and then a book from the early 20th century, deals with many similar themes. You know, Japan was in this period of adapting between a traditional society and an industrial society. And, you know, again, I have to say, global technological materialism is what comes, the end point of, industrialism and you know, this kind of free market and all this kind of stuff. You get to this point where you have, you know, I'll just keep calling it the GTM. I'll call it GTM. And you know, that's what Mishima is rebelling against. And when you rebel against it, you often have to use a force from the past in order to defeat it. So, you know, Mishima, he has his images of, you know, his Roman sculptures. He sort of, in a lot of ways, is an archaeo-futurist, you know. Like you've said before, you've mentioned Vaporwave in respect to the film Mishima. And definitely, I mean, there's a surrealistic 80s quality that you can see throughout all the fantasy sequences in the film. It's totally there.
Yeah, you see all these different kind of genres pulled into one. You have the sort of references to ancient Japan. You have the kind of modern society as it kind of exists. And you have these fantasy sequences, which are very 1980s. Very kind of a vaporwave feel, but they also combine aspects of ancient Japanese culture with futurism, and that was kind of a design preference for the filmmakers, but it'd be interesting to see what, if Mishima, what his personal take would have been on that. On the aesthetics of the film, would he favor a pure traditional aesthetic, or would that kind of... the aesthetic of the dream sequences, which are very retro-futurist, that appealed to him.
I think he would have enjoyed them. I mean, they were designed by a woman named Aiko Ishoda. I believe that is her name. And I used to be a little more literate with Japanese names. I'm just not reading them a lot, so I apologize to any Japanese listeners if I'm getting the pronunciation wrong. But, you know, Aiko, she designed... have you seen Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Francis Ford Coppola film?
Yeah, I've seen it.
I really like that movie, and I really like the design, and she designed that film as well. And I think that film has sort of weird, archaeo-futuristic quality to it. You know what I mean? Like, it's a 90s film that sort of is this, like, grotesque version of the 1800s. You know what I'm saying there? You see that? Do you see that with the Coppola film?
Sure. Well, with these, like, dream sequences, there's a number of different ones. I think, to the audience, they can be confusing because at first you don't know whether they're dreams or they're a story in his life or they're an acting sequence. But they are a lot of the dream sequences are based on the series of novels that Mishima wrote. But if you just look at the aesthetics, there's the Temple of the Golden Pavilion, and that's it's sort of a reference more to the kind of the traditional Japanese aesthetic, but it's still kind of futuristic in its own sense. And then there's sort of the there's also that scene where he's in that hotel. It's like a kind of a erotic hotel. And that's very kind of a very 80s, very kind of a retro futurist. You know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah. Where it's all pink. Yes, certainly. And I mean, also it's like there's this really robust nude Japanese woman who has kind of like a pink glow on her. And the blinds from the window are covering her body. And I find it kind of interesting that at that point in the movie, it's sort of like, you know, there's a lot of like exploitation of like the flesh in Mishima. You know, the body is something that is shown to the viewer throughout the film, you know. And what I find to be interesting is that while a lot of movies from the 80s, you know, I'm not even sure if this theme might even follow through a lot of other 80s movies. It's like we sort of look at these films as like glorifying a over-sexualization of the female figure. You know, that's what all this kind of feminist film theory would say, like the camera as the director's dick or something. That's I took a feminist film theory class with this crazy feminist, like Jewish, you know, like the like, you know, it's like a stereotype, like a insane Jewish feminist. And I remember one time someone criticized Israel and she like kicked them out of the classroom. So So obvious, now I think like, okay, this lady's obviously a little off her, rocker, whatever. She's, obviously has her own agendas, but she would just go on about how the film was like, the director, the camera represented
Well, this.
penis. She would say this, that the camera represented his penis, and all films were like exploitation of the female body. But I feel like in a lot of 80s movies, it's almost like it's of the male and the female body, like the really beautiful, like really beautiful sort of cut, full figured women. And, masculine Arnold Schwarzenegger type, like that's like both sexes are kind of brought to that kind of Superman level in 80s films. I don't.
You also see this kind of a lot of 80s films are very kind of have this like dreamlike otherworldly feel to them because they're on the right balance. I think a lot of it's cultural, but also has to do with special effects because special effects got to a certain level, but now special effects are so advanced everything is too fake. And what's kind of ironic is back in the 80s people we're always saying, oh, the 80s are so plastic, and you haven't heard that until the 90s. But there is something really kind of a dreamlike about a lot of these different 80s films, like something kind of otherworldly that you don't see. A very
Well,
like a fantasy.
yeah. No, I definitely get where you're coming from, but I feel like there are new films that have a really amazing quality to them. I've seen films in the, that have come out in the last 10 or so years. Like there's a Greek director named Georgios Lanthimos just made a movie with Colin Farrell, his first film in English, called The Lobster, which I think is good. But his other two films, Dogtooth and Alps, absolutely amazing films, really great, and it's like realist cinema. People who listen to our show would like it. It's not fluff. Robert, I think a problem with film, what has happened to film, why films do not have what you're referring to, Robert, that quality, that the feel, the dreamlike feel, that is the essence of the art. And now when you go to the theater and you go watch Transformers or the latest Adam Sandler movie, you're not seeing art that has an essence. Films, I mean, comedy, had there was times where you could go and see something like like in the 30s, like Charlie Chaplin. That's art. That's Charlie Chaplin's films are wonderfully composed. People, there were people who followed that tradition. That were, the Marx Brothers. These guys were making interesting films, but after a while, it became a business. It became a business, and the art lost its essence. And now it's a global business, and films are made for, the release, like Warcraft. No one went to go see Warcraft in America. People in China went to go see Warcraft. Films are now made for the globalist, they're now for the globalist village. That's what they're made for. So that's why they're not
It's
good anymore.
interesting you brought that up because of both films. Taxi Driver was like a major Hollywood film, but wasn't a Mishima scene. It wasn't. It was still like in the major theaters, but in some ways, it's seen as more of an art film.
Well,
Like your
yeah.
average person has not heard of it the same way they've heard of a Taxi Driver.
Well, certainly. I mean, because number one, it's in Japanese, and your average film goer is not going to want to see a film in a language that's not the one they speak. I'm sure we all know people who don't want to watch things that are in black and white. They don't want to watch a movie made or made before 1995 or something. There's this weird like needing to stick on the current year idea of progress, So Mishima is directed by Paul Schrader, writer of Taxi Driver, director of Cat People and American Gigolo. Those films also, American Gigolo is a movie that follows a similar path to what we're talking about as well. I think Schrader, as an artist, is someone who is an aristocratic individualist. I think a lot of directors, you know, like Godard and Truffaut, they would all write about the auteur theory in the, you know, 50s in France when they were, you know, had their film set on.
He's an auteur. Filmmakers and artists who would identify with the left deep down are aristocratic individualists.
Yes, deep down are aristocratic. They're leftists because that's the religion of the people around them, and they don't want to be purged from the village. That's why they're leftist. That's why they maybe they're nice and they have some egalitarian principles or something. But there's a concept of like aristocratic egalitarianism. I see a lot of these auteur types as aristocratic individualists. I see Bret Easton Ellis as one completely. You know, he's a with American Psycho, and I feel like, you know, like Milo Yiannopoulos, you know, you can hate him or love him or whatever, but he almost seems like he comes from a Bret Easton Ellis novel. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I see that same.
It's a philosophy, not a government system. You could have different views. You could be a libertarian. You could even have like socialist views. You could have more like conservative right wing views. It's a philosophy, not like a government system per se.
Certainly. It's a way of going about life. And one can succeed at being an aristocratic individualist, or they can fail. I mean, you know, you can, like I said before, you can say whatever you like about whatever you want about Milo. I have my own problems with this guy, but he is someone who, there weren't people like him a couple of years ago. He went against the tide, took a risk, made what someone like Peter Thiel would call the contrarian investment. He bet on the long tail, and he's made a career for himself. You know, and I think
that's the thing is that with aristocratic individualists, you see them. Some of them become great, very successful as directors, as artists,
as speakers,
as public figures. Yeah. But you have a failed, plenty of failed like aristocratic individualists.
Just said Elliot Rodger right there.
Yeah, definitely. He called himself an aristocrat.
I know. Well, there's the whole sort of meme culture around him too. I mean, a friend of mine who I talk to about a lot of just kind of philosophical stuff or whatever. I was talking to him about having like meetup groups or something for like a group of us that like to talk about these kind of ideas, and he said to me, an aristocratic individualist would just have followers. They wouldn't be part of a group. and I think that's kind of, it's a philosophy. It's a way of living your life. And aristocratic individualists, there's going to be some good apples that fall from the tree, and there's going to be some bad apples like Charles Manson. You know, Charles Manson was an artist, a musician. He was part of the Topanga Canyon scene in California in the early 70s, where you had Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and all these hippy dippy types out there having sex and wearing Navajo rugs and taking LSD. And, you know, honestly, I wish I could live in that universe. That's the Topanga Canyon of the early 1970s.
We did touch on Elliot Rodger, and I was actually kind of thinking you do have that theme in Mishima when he's young, because he was born from an aristocratic background. He was descended from a samurai, and there's a scene where he was being bullied, and he was kind of wimpy in that scene, but he made a big deal about his background, and they kind of laughed at him. And then there was that scene, the sequence based on his novel, The Temple of the Golden a pavilion, and that's sort of an erotic series where there's these two young women, and there's another man who seduces them. And I think Mishima's character in that sequence is, I think he's a mute, I think, but he ends up getting rejected by humiliating himself, so he burns down the Temple of the Golden Pavilion because it symbolizes beauty. And that was actually based on a true story of an arson attack in Japan. But there's that kind of a theme of like romantic rejection and wanting to destroy anything that's symbolic of beauty, and that goes back to that theme I was touching on.
Well, Robert, there's also the idea of like sexual purity, and I think that this is something that a lot of people don't really want to think about or talk about a lot in our current year or time or whatever. And the whole idea, I mean, I was reading Andy Nowicki's book, Confessions of a Would-Be Wanker. Have you ever read this?
Oh, yeah, I have read it.
I think that that is a really interesting book, and he shows this idea of, like, of sex as a kind of corruptive act, where one has this innocence in a prepubescent time that they kind of lose in an effort to be one of the cool kids and be accepted. You know, when the kids start to curse, and, you know, if someone steals something from a grocery store, then, you know, fingering someone behind park or whatever, you know, it's behind some tree at the park. You know, there's all these kind of weird activities that kids get into in their preteen years, you know. And I think at this time, a lot of modern social leftists would chastise me for this, but I view that in a lot of ways as a time of corruption. And Mishima's character, he in a lot of ways wanted to keep his sexual innocence. The character of the mute wanted to keep his sexual innocence. And when the woman that, you know, is like seducing him, is she sees his inability, he cannot function, he sort of just breaks down. It's like he wants to have a sexuality, but he wants to have a sexuality that is a restrained sexuality. He doesn't want to have the kind of Wilhelm Reich or Sigmund Freud interpretation of sexuality, where the old Catholic view is repressive and garbage, and one just needs to have total openness with sex and stick all sorts of dildos everywhere. You know, that's there's sort of this idea that we have this problem of sexual repression, and that's it, and we just need sexual freedom, then everything will be good. But
Taxi Driver also touches upon theme, because there's the character Travis. He meets that girl in the...
Yes, Sybil Shepherd's character, office, yeah.
And then he eventually convinces her to go out on a date, but he's very kind of... He's kind of awkward and oblivious about what to do, because he's been really, like, isolated and alone, so he takes her to a pornographic theater, and he just totally blows it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the character of Travis also is a Vietnam veteran, and I think that also is a parallel to Mishima, because they're both men very affected by war.
Well, Mishima in the story, he got out of the military because he had health issues, but I think he felt kind of ashamed about it, so he sort of wanted to overcompensate by becoming like this great warrior and proving himself as a warrior.
Well, what Bickle is doing is, I think he had, this is just a sort of guess from a viewer on the outside, is that Bickle strived for greatness, or maybe he was just drafted, but he was a soldier, you know, he was a man representing, there's this idea of like the Vietnam War that a lot of people in our circles don't really talk about, where, you know, what is this experience of kind of white and black men in American men in the Vietnamese jungle? Like, what is that experience, you know, where you had segregation, you know, that was put in place for years, and, you know, as soon as the water fountains don't have the black and white signifying, as soon as that's gone, then the guys are thrown together in warfare together. They're thrown together, you know, these guys who had their racial tension or whatnot, they're thrown together. And it seems like, you know, when Bickle gets back, he comes to America, comes to New York, and he basically says, what was I fighting for? You know, there's this idea of decline that exists within Taxi Driver. He's continually talking about someone, quote unquote, wiping the scum off the streets.
And, oh yeah, and but he's kind of like, you don't, he's not explicit about it, but it could be interpreted many different ways by different people. Like, he's talking to that liberal politician, and the guy's kind of like, he's sort of like, he wants to be polite, but he's kind of dismissive about the idea. He's like, well, I have plans to do this and this, and...
Yeah, Bickle goes on a little rant about how he wants to, a great rain to come down and wipe the scum off the streets, and Palpatine, or whatever his name is, the politician, he sort of has no idea how to react, and I like that scene because it sort of shows the dialectic. It sort of shows Bickle as the unadulterated, unfiltered, just man. You know, that's what the way that you know, a man outside of time thinks, a man outside of nature. He's more than likely thinking in those terms, but. You know, that's sort of the dark side of the Force, if you will, the riding the tiger, and Palpatine, the liberal. You know, he's caught up in the hegemony of egalitarianism and utilitarianism, just trying to seem good to the other people by doing good. You know, there's this whole archetype I see of like the politician as sort of Heidegger's inauthentic Dasein, and actually the kind of remote weirdo outside of society. To me, I believe them much more to be the authentic Dasein, the authentic being.
What have been some of the sort of mainstream liberal critiques of both those films?
Well, both Taxi Driver and Mishima have been seen by film theorists or whatever as being fascist films, and that's not something that I would necessarily deny about these films. I think that you can certainly see themes of fascism in both of these films, and but I feel that, you know, in a lot of art you see reflections of fascism. I think
that's kind of funny you say that, because I saw that discussion between Schrader and Richard Wollstonecraft, we interviewed on Facebook.
Yeah. Richard has been on our show before, and Richard is certainly an aristocratic individualist, someone who believes in himself very strongly as an artist and has a will that he follows, and is, I think, a pretty brave person.
And even, you could even make the case for his character in Pearls Before Swine.
Oh, certainly. And, you know, but Richard exists in the world of underground film and underground art, you know. And Schrader has his associations with people that are kind of, you know, you have the edge of, like, the edge of the current year, the edge of the simulation.
Schrader is someone who is subversive, but he still has to be within sort of the Hollywood liberal framework at the same time.
Exactly. Well, yeah. Okay. So, like,
that's the world he exists in.
Exactly. I mean, because if he says something, it'll be reframed, like what Tila Tequila was talking about when we had her on. You know, if she said something that is a little bit damaging, or as I love what the Cosmopolitans say, that anything that doesn't follow their narrative will lead to fascism. So, like, Tila Tequila, because she says things that are, you know, Tila is definitely an aristocratic individualist. She might even be the aristocratic individualist. You know, and she's out of the box, and when, what did she say that, she said the word spazzy or spurgy or something, and they got really, the Big Brother people got really mad at her.
Spaz,
yeah, exactly. So, you know, Richard Richard's one of those guys. He's just on the periphery, you know, and that's where Boyd Rice exists. And I think Bret Easton Ellis exists there. I think maybe Scott Adams, the Dilbert creator. There's people who do exist in the mainstream and are a bit unafraid to voice some opinions that not everybody will like. Maybe even Dave Rubin, you could say, is that. I mean, you know, he plays it very, very safe, but he was fired from Young Turks. He existed in the blue pill world, you know? It's really hard for people like us to even remember or understand that the blue pill world exists, where you have to follow the rules of PC and you can rise above and become a, you know, make a lot of money, you know, and networking.
There's this, like, kind of, like, blogger named Vox Day, who's, like, a...
I'm familiar with him.
Yeah, he's, like, kind of on the Manosphere site, but he has this whole concept of these different, like gammas and sigmas, if you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, the kind of, the Greek male archetypes, or, you know, you could, people, sort of, I don't know, like the wolf delineations. I've seen some guys on Facebook who, we all know they're betas. I've seen some betas on Facebook say, like, well, human beings are not wolves. Like, don't categorize us like we're animals. But it's like,
well, I don't agree entirely with all his classifications. But you could make the case that, like, a sigmas are like the successful aristocratic individualist.
Yeah.
Gammas are like the kind of failed aristocratic
exactly.
individualist.
Yeah, that's totally it.
Then with my take on the whole, so alphas would be the people who have power within society, and then the betas are like the conformist masses.
Exactly. So
so it's different. It's a different way of looking at things than your, like, standard manosphere view.
Exactly, yeah. I'm not into the manosphere myself.
Neither am I, but...
Yeah, I don't like, you know, male chauvinism, and, you know, I think part of being a, you know, aristocratic individualist is you know, being kind of pompous yet respectful of people. you know, someone like Richard Wollstonecraft, perfect example of that. You know, just in his, he's a brilliant sigma, you know, the sigma is like the owl, you know, you have like the sheeps and the sheep.
The sigma would be like someone who's a rebel.
Well, they undermine the alpha.
A gamma would be like a
Elliot Rodger. Elliot Rodger.
Yeah. This is my unique, perspective, so I'm going to coin it, but. No one's ever made this case, but I would say that both the Sigma and the Gamma are two wings of aristocratic individualism. But Vox Day actually doesn't say that. He never makes any connections between the two. So his outlook, I'm basing my ideas from his outlook, but his outlook is flawed.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, I have seen that kind of yin-yang between Alpha, Beta, Sigma, Gamma. Myself, I've seen that. I've seen this kind of grid
also,
in my mind.
Also, I think someone could be a gamma sigma hybrid too.
Yeah, well, then you have alpha betas and all this kind of stuff. I mean, betas and alphas, those are people who follow universalism. They follow egalitarianism. You know, in their own ways. A lot of times, if these people are quote unquote red pilled, they will be. Christian red-pilled people. You know what I mean? It's like...
So would you say that both characters, Mishima and Travis, are gammas, become sigmas?
I think that both of them start out as gammas bordering on omegas. The omega is just the kind of complete black sheep failure. And what happens is that I think that... Mishima evolves into kind of a gamma alpha or a sigma alpha. Kind of, you know, he becomes like the eagle or something. He moves from being the owl outside of the dialectic of sheep and wolves and moves into almost being an eagle. And then I think that that Travis he starts from that beta gamma sort of wimp place, but he sort of never truly leaves it. I mean, he becomes stronger. He becomes tougher.
Like the last scene with Sybil Shepherd, it's kind of bittersweet because she sort of acknowledges his existence, but it's not implied that there's going to be some kind of romantic relationship.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. You know, a true aristocratic individualist is someone who is able to live their own life for themselves. There is no need to impress other people. You have your world, your idea of reality, and if other people want to join it, great. If other people want to do their own thing, whatever. But an aristocratic individualist does not depend upon other people to validate themselves. The aristocratic individualist validates himself from within. He completely validates himself. And, you know, Elliot Rodger and Travis Bickle fail because Elliot Rodger needs affirmation from women in the same way that Travis Bickle does.
This kind of gets into like a James O'Meara territory.
Yeah, totally.
Because of his homosexuality, in a sense, because homosexuals are not dependent on women, they can sort of be more free to be nonconformist. And you kind of see that. I could make the case of Milo.
Yeah, certainly. Or even, you know, there's a lot of thinkers. Oscar Wilde, for instance,
he definitely was an aristocratic individualist.
John Waters, look at John Waters. You know, look at the way that he.
Definitely.
John Waters always wears very, you know, there's like designers like Comme des Garçons, Ray.
Or Liberace would be a great example.
Yeah, certainly. But you know, there's sort of like these kind of more flamboyant, sort of avant-garde. Designers from like Japan and Western Europe in the 1970s and to 90s would sort of be the prime time of this kind of like fashion. And I think in a lot of ways that's sort of the way that an aristocratic individualist dresses and sort of, you know, I think that the kind of, you know, John Waters wearing a Comme des Garçons suit with all designs all over it and like a weird tie and weird socks with his little mustache. You know, there's just this image of a kind of, there's a feeling and an energy that comes with the aristocratic individualist. Lynch is another very good example.
With sort of the aesthetics of the film, you did talk about the aesthetics of Mishima. I do want to kind of talk about the aesthetics of Taxi Driver.
Sure.
I mean, we talked about this on the San Francisco trip show, but I posted those pictures from my trip. You saw those?
Oh, yeah. They were really cool. And you can see how there exists kind of a Taxi Driver or a Blade Runner kind of neo-noir with some of these more down-and-out areas. They have reflections of Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver is very interesting in how it romanticizes filth and romanticizes a kind of a decaying city.
I think see that with like the sci-fi film Blade Runner too.
Yeah,
with sort of a neo-noir.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that there is a certain kind of adventurous spirit amongst our people or whatever who. You know, they want to live in dangerous areas, and they want to sort of live life on the edge. It's a blessing and a curse that
I sent you. Did you see that thing from that blogger? Rabbit and I interviewed this blogger, Thomas Rinaldi, from this site New York Neon,
sure.
And he had a whole like post about Taxi Driver.
Yeah, what was his take on it?
He didn't have an explicit take about the film, but he did document like a lot of photographs from that film that capture that kind of gritty film noir feel.
That's very interesting. You know, I'll have to go check those out. Yeah, there's a kind of New York that Taxi Driver presents that does not exist anymore.
I haven't been to New York. I mean, I was talking about my observations from San Francisco. Is there any kind of remnant of that, or that's all gone through gentrification?
Out in New York?
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you go to New York and you take the bus in or whatever, and you end up in Times Square area, you still see the 25-cent porno jack off booths. They still exist.
Really? I thought Giuliani cleaned all that stuff up.
No, there's still this weird kind of like porn tourism thing where it's like it's bizarre. There's this over commercialized New York that exists around Times Square that almost feels like a shopping mall. And the further away from that you get, the better it kind of is, the stronger the kind of culture is or whatever. But New York has sort of died out. I've seen it kind of die, become its soul, its essence has been drained from it over a period of time.
Well,
I think
what's interesting about the whole concept of like a porn theater or like a porn district,
yeah,
is if the internet kind of like the internet porn is like everywhere. It's on your iPhone.
I know
the concept of a porn theater is taking erotica pornography and putting it into an actual physical geographic location instead of like on your iPhone.
Well, you're still just looking at images though. I mean, I can understand someone saying that
they have like those live sex shows, maybe not in New York, but like Amsterdam.
Well, yeah. See, when you have sexuality being presented in the flesh, you know, like a strip club or
something. It also kind of marginalizes it into a specific district. When it's everywhere, it kind of loses its sense of being dirty.
Yeah, that is pretty funny. Yeah, if you want to go, if someone's going to go masturbate at a porno theater, it's, you know, there's this whole element of, oh gosh, you're going to see a porn movie. But now pornography has become this thing that everyone has on their phone, you know. Or, I mean, I don't know. I personally think porn is awful and really, you know, a shit thing in Western society. I think it's ruining us in a lot of ways. I think that, yeah, it's sort of warps the mind. It's, you know, one's own... there's a lot of thinkers like, you know, I'm not into this Freudian stuff or whatever, but Lacan would say the libido, we're motivated, our narrative is motivated by our libido. And you see that, I mean, you see it in Taxi Driver. He goes for Sybil Shepherd, he can't get her, so he must change himself to impress Jodie Foster. You know, his libido is driving his narrative, is creating his narrative. And Mishima, you know, he's touching the image of the man against the tree. I forget what the image is of. I know that it's I think it's an Italian image.
And then definitely John Hinckley Jr., who tried to kill Reagan, he was inspired by that film, and he felt he had to do something
to impress
like that to impress Jodie Foster.
Yeah, yeah,
same theme.
Exactly.
I think he just got out of...
Oh, jeez. Yeah. I mean, he's sort of making this kind of... he's like a guy who goes and tries to slay a dragon, you know. But that's sort of this gamma failed version of aristocratic individualism. But yeah, I think that, you know, because the libido creates a narrative in so many cases, it's important to have like a legitimate libido and not just, you know, that's what part of becoming being a homo sapien, being a evolved ape, part of being that is just being in touch and comfortable with your sexuality but not exploitive of it. And I think that porn and the porn culture and the world of porn, what it does is it allows you just to mute your sexuality with this, you know, with these electronic devices. And, you know, it's really easy just to jump from homo sapien to homo economicus, which is just the identity removed consumer worker.
I want to talk about the music in the film. You have in Taxi Driver, you have a Bernard Herrmann's jazz, and that has a kind of a film noir feel to it. It kind of captures the sense of like loneliness in the big city and the sense of like urban grittiness. And then you have Glass's classical music, which it's classical, but at the same time it has a very like 80s retro futurist feel to it. And it's a more minimalistic. So they're both great, great works of music, but they go perfectly with the film. The interesting is that Schrader could have gone with something maybe more stereotypically Japanese. But I think that music, even though it's not Japanese, it still goes with the Japanese culture. But I think both those works of music really go with both those films.
Yeah. Two really great scores. Bernard Herrmann and Philip Glass are both, you know, Jewish composers, but they come from very different places. I think even mentally, they come from different places. I know Philip Glass is someone who's very into Buddhism and John Cage and this minimalism. Bernard Herrmann, he was composing scores for Alfred Hitchcock in the 1950s. He's a you know, not of old school Hollywood, but you know, of the kind of classic film era, the sort of end of the classic film era. Bernard Herrmann was an important composer. He was a big shot composer. People went to him. If you were a big film director, you wanted Bernard Herrmann to do your score, and you know he was an inventive. His scores were inventive. They weren't just fluff. Like, you know, the Psycho soundtrack is very inventive, just in terms of how the music interacts with the image. Like, it's music that is created for images, and Bernard Herrmann was very good at creating music for images. But Philip Glass comes from a different background in working with, you know, I'm not sure if he was working with the Kronos Quartet before or after, but he has this whole John Cage minimalist background. And he makes works that, yeah, you say this kind of retro futurist thing, but I almost view it as like modern classical or whatever. And, you know, we can say what we want about modern art, but I think there is something about minimalist composition, about people like John Adams, the composer, and Philip Glass, and they make a very interesting. There's very interesting qualities to their music, and it goes along very well with images. And there's definitely a difference in the kind of score of a lush kind of romantic Bernard Herrmann score and a minimalistic Philip Glass score. There's a difference in the way that you respond to it, but I think both aesthetics are very, very interesting, and I think it's, you sort of see the evolution of a good film scores, at least, because there's so many just garbage film scores, but you see the evolution from 1976, Herrmann, he dies around that time, and then sort of people like Philip Glass taking the range and making, people that were making interesting scores around the time of the early 80s. I think John Carpenter is another person.
Yeah, also you have what's his name? Vangelis?
Vangelis. Yeah, exactly. So you have like a transition. Bernard Herrmann is very old school, but you had people, you have like a dialectic that emerges. And, on one side of it, you can see composers like Alan Silvestri or John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith. These are guys who are making these loud, bombastic film scores. In that, in many ways,
major films have like really cheesy, lame music.
Yeah, well, you know, people like John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith, I think that they are actually pretty interesting composers. You know, I like John Williams' work. I think that, you know, the music from Star Wars is good. You know, like the Force theme, the binary sunset theme or whatever. I think that's a good piece of music. But I think that there's something that's more interesting about people like Philip Glass or John Carpenter.
Because they're not as explicitly catchy as like the Star Wars soundtrack.
Yeah, it exists in another place. It's not just fluff that tells you, okay, you hear this sound, feel good. You hear this sound, feel bad. There's more nuance.
Wasn't there a kind of big revival of a classical music in the 80s?
Well, what do you mean, like Miloš Forman film about Amadeus?
Oh, yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, I mean, in the
or 80s, even if you've seen like the Big Picture with like Kevin Bacon and Martin Short.
The Big Picture. Oh, that's from the late 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of referring more to the minimalistic early 80s. I'm being really really nerdy, but what was that?
Really, really spurgy.
I'm being really spurgy, yeah. But what was I going to say about the classical revival in the 80s? Look, it's interesting. Mishima is a film of the 80s, and
actually, it's interesting as Mishima came out. It was released about like a week before I was born.
Wow, that's interesting. I mean, it's funny. I was listening to David Cole talking, and he was speaking on that Savage Hippie podcast that he does, and he was like, I hate the 80s. Everything 80s is garbage. Manhunter is a good film. It's better than Red Dragon, but it's garbage because it has all the stupid 80s stuff in it. And then I'm thinking about, like, James O. James the Era. And he's like,
oh, yeah. And then, said this fucking worth the interior, but I was doing this kind of like painting of like a interior, and someone in my art class said, Alex, that reminds me of the film like Blue Velvet.
Oh yeah, Blue Velvet is a really good movie, and it has its 80s quality. Like, there is a, you know, yeah, I mean, I agree with James O. James Miera over David Cole, because it's like 80s is good. Like, there's a lot of great stuff from the 1980s. I think that might have been a serious high point. I mean, maybe you had a lot of crap mainstream fluff, but you know what? I don't even know, because
you went to high school in the 80s, so he associates that maybe with bad memories. I don't really want to get too personal, but like, I went to high school in the early 2000s, so like, I really have a strong dislike for like the era from like 2000 to 2004.
Oh, I see. So it's like, you know, if you have a time that's like shitty, you don't want to see stuff that reminds you of that time.
That could be.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, everybody has like shitty times. I mean, I think the 80s were a time where jocks were allowed to like be jocks. I mean, it's like the kind of cool guy 70s thing ended, and you had this Reaganism and you know, What was that? Like that show with Michael J. Fox, Family Ties, Alex P. Keaton.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like the parents are like ex-hippies, and he's like, you know, this little Reaganite, little Milton Friedman lover. And, you know, in the 80s, guys like that could have free range. He was sort of douchebag materialist. Materialist individualists, you know, not people who believe in a kind of aristocratic principles.
I would like to talk about kind of Mishima's legacy, because I think the reason Mishima was, he has this following and a lot of people who admire him, but Japan at the time was going through like immense economic and technological progress, and that's sort of why he wasn't successful. I mean, he didn't go out there to literally have a military coup. He went out there to make a cultural impact. But I think if he were around today in Japan, or even a similar figure in the West, I think he would make a much stronger impact than he did back then, which was a time of great prosperity.
Yeah, people who are aristocratic individualists need to come to prominence in times of turmoil. That's when people sort of need them, and it's harder for someone to make an impact when everyone is content with reality. When people start, I mean, Elvis Presley wasn't necessary in the early 80s. But once people became afraid in the Cold War, of the threat of Russia, they sought entertainment in Elvis and rock and roll, you know. So I think that the aristocratic individualist shines in a time of you know, as the Chinese say, you know, the curse of the interesting times or whatever. And I just wanted to say one more thing. One more little thing. Well, I just, you know, and about, you know, just aristocratic individualism and artists and stuff. I think it's very important, as we've said on the show before, to go out and support people who are artists and writers and people who are doing original things, especially in the arts, because it's difficult for these people to make money. So I know, like, Robert, like, you have your paintings and...
yeah, and also go out and buy. I'm selling my textile, I quote, women's fashion.
Oh, yeah, you have... Yeah, well, you should put a link to that within the show. And, you know, like, I know there's Brandon Adamson's book, Beatnik Fascism. And I just bought one of those bullet necklaces from Charles Kraft's site. You know, and someone like Charles Kraft, he's been kind of... exposed in the media as being a quote unquote bad guy. So, you know, he's probably lost a lot of his old audience. So if you're a member of his new audience, it's good to go out and support artists that are kind of our comrades in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't agree with everything Charles says. I'm sure he wouldn't agree with everything I say, but I want to try to support these people.
Well, Alex, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
It's been great. This is, I think, been one of our most interesting shows.